May it please the court, my name is Daniel Gregory with the law firm of Gregory, Golden & Landrieu in Durango, Colorado. I represent the appellants, Mr. Leslie Evans and his wife Esther Evans. My attorney registration number is 22949. Mr. Evans is in the court with us here today, sitting off in the front row. A nuisance was established in this case by the uncontradicted evidence. The primary issue to be resolved on appeal, therefore, is whether the interpretation below that the declaration excused any nuisance arising from the operation of the brew pub constitutes reversible error. The final order of the trial court made it clear that the basis for its decision was that the declaration was, and I quote from the trial judge's decision, an exculpatory agreement prohibiting any nuisance claim so long as the premises was being used as a brew pub, regardless of the effect of that operation on neighboring properties. The error in misconstruing the declaration was in confusing the term reasonable use as required by the declaration for the operation of the brew pub with the additional terms in the declaration of a normal use and an intended use.
Mr. Gregory, I take it that the trial judge assumed that any use that was reasonable in a business sense was acceptable, as opposed to the requirement that whatever use you are engaged in, you have to do it in a reasonable way.
That is what the trial judge seemed to suggest in his opinion. In the judge's final decision, and I apologize, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. The trial judge, in his decision, made it very clear that the basis of his decision was that the use of the brew pub to brew beer was a reasonable use. That's page 9 of his decision. He shows us that he gets to that decision by also holding that the provision in the declaration bars any claim for a nuisance. In fact, and on page 12 of his decision, after citing the elements that we're familiar with under Colorado jurisprudence for a nuisance, a substantial invasion of another's property that causes an unreasonable interference with their right to use and enjoyment of their property, the trial judge did not address those issues. Instead, the trial judge concluded that the plaintiffs knowingly relinquished any right to make a claim for a nuisance caused by the operations. He then called the declaration and the provision in the declaration an exculpatory agreement. In fact, it is not an exculpatory agreement. Again, the distinction that was lost on the trial court was that in looking at the critical language under the declaration, which is found in section 8.05, that critical language says the normal and reasonable use of the units for their intended use shall not constitute a nuisance. We know from Colorado jurisprudence that in order to properly construe a document such as this, a declaration, which is a contract between members of the association, that we employ standard principles of contract interpretation. One of those most fundamental principles is that we look at documents in pari materia. We look at documents as a whole in the context of the language that is in that document so that we assign each of the words in the document meaning and so that none of those words is rendered superfluous.
Well, Mr. Gregory, didn't the trial court judge here conclude that the brew pub was being used in a reasonable manner because it was just being used as a brew pub, even though it had increased its production of beer?
The trial judge did conclude that, and we argue that that was error, because the trial judge, in concluding that it was a reasonable use, we suggest confused that term with the other terms that must also be given meaning, the terms normal use and intended use. The language...
Mr. Gregory, let me ask you this. The intended use of that particular unit was to be used as a brew pub.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, right? And so we're saying that, and the language says, the normal and reasonable use of that unit for its intended purpose shall not constitute a nuisance. So the normal use of that unit for its intended purpose would be as a brew pub.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
So that would not constitute it as a nuisance.
So long as using it for its normal purpose, that of a brew pub, you are also using it reasonably. When we give effect to each of the terms in the declaration so that none are rendered superfluous, we say, what's the normal use of a brew pub? To brew beer. What's the intended use? To operate it as a brew pub. What is the reasonable use? To operate it in a reasonable manner such that it does not constitute a nuisance. And once again, we look at the language of the declaration. The language of the declaration does not begin and end with one sentence in section 8.05. The first part of section 8.05, again, looking at this as a whole, says a nuisance is defined as any activity which poses an unreasonable risk of harm, which constitutes a substantial invasion of a unit owner's use and enjoyment of their unit. It goes on to say, no nuisance shall be permitted, nor any use activity which is the source of unreasonable annoyance, or which unreasonably offends or disturbs, or which may unreasonably interfere with peaceful enjoyment. That's the first part of Section 8.05. It then says the normal and reasonable use. Section 8.06, which immediately follows that, says no odor shall be emitted from, and I'm quoting directly from the declaration, any portion of the common interest community which would reasonably be found by others to be noxious or offensive. Any portion clearly includes the brew pub. So when we look at the document together, we can see that we are not attempting to avoid the declaration. The defendants below, appellees here, and the trial court both said, the defendant said, this language about the brew pub creates a safe harbor. The trial judge said it's an exculpatory agreement. In fact, that is the improper construction. When we view it as a whole, it's very clear that what the declaration did was take the common law definition of a nuisance and say that you can operate this brew pub for its intended use. You can operate it normally. But if you operate it unreasonably, such that it violates the use and enjoyment of the other owners, then you have committed a nuisance. This declaration, when read together, is clear that it essentially requires that the brew pub be operated reasonably. We can look at some of our precedent in this state. And we've, of course, cited these cases in our brief. Staley versus Sagal, or Miller versus Carnation. As the court knows, in those cases, in Staley versus Sagal, there was a hog farm. And people moved next to it. The hog farm was operating. And the hog farm was operating for its intended use. It was a hog farm. In Miller versus Carnation, we had an agricultural farm with chickens. Once again, that farm was being operated for its intended use as an agricultural chicken farm. So a farm can be used as a pig farm and may be able to function as a pig farm without being a nuisance. In fact, the injunction that was issued in Staley versus Sagal required exactly that. That's what we sought in this case, to take the use as it was ultimately done once the mechanical fixes were made and make this a reasonable use.
Mr. Gregory, if I may interrupt, here the trial court judge ruled against Mr. and Mrs. Evans on several different grounds. One of them that you mentioned was that he construed the covenants as an exculpatory clause. But second, my understanding is that he also said that based on the evidence that he heard, he didn't believe that there was a showing or a sufficient showing of unreasonable use of the brew pub. And third, he also concluded that the evidence didn't establish that they had been damaged as a result of having to sell their condominium. So is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement.
So to come back to the second reason, when you've said various times that you focused on the word reasonable, but isn't the determination of whether the smell from the brew pub was reasonable or unreasonable a question for the trial court to determine based upon listening to all of the witnesses at the trial?
As the court knows, normally findings of fact by a trial court are given great deference. And if there is competing evidence, competent evidence in the record to support a trial judge's factual findings, then they are reviewed under the abuse of discretion standard. Here, and this is a critical point for this case, there is no contradictory evidence whatsoever in the record to suggest that there was anything other than a nuisance, and that nuisance tells us that there was therefore per se an unreasonable use. Specifically, we had testimony from both Mr. and Mrs. Evans that this odor, which began in 2009, caused sleeplessness, headaches, nauseousness, drove them out of their unit on not an everyday basis, but a regular, although intermittent basis. We had undisputed, uncontradicted evidence from four real estate agents, three who had worked for the Evans as seller's agents, Sally Puff Courtney and her assistants, and one that had worked for the ultimate buyer, Mr. Stiff Patterson. They all testified, yes, this condition existed. It was such a condition, one of the realtors testified that she had planned to have an open house over Christmas, a peak time for real estate sales in the town of Telluride. And she had to close the open house because she was sick to her stomach. That is the very definition of a nuisance. When you are caught, and we had a buyer who came in from out of state, who entered into a contract, and in that contract put in a special provision that said, until this situation is remedied, we will not close. When you are creating conditions like that on your property and allowing it to invade your neighbor's property, that is an unreasonable use. Once again, just because something is an intended use, that does not answer the question of whether the use is reasonable. We can operate hog farms, we can operate chicken ranches, we can operate dog kennels to go to another case, we can operate a brew pub as it's being done now once the mechanical fixes were in place to in fact require a reasonable use.
Mr. Gregory, you asked to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. You have just under 2 minutes left.
I'm going to very quickly take just a little bit of that time, if I may, and try and wrap up, and then I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I could, Your Honor. In this case, the trial judge, on page 12, said, after he cited the elements of a nuisance, the court didn't address the evidence. Instead, he said that by purchasing the property, the plaintiffs knowingly relinquished any claim to make any right to make a claim for a nuisance. That simply is not the proper construction of this particular declaration. In the case at bar, it is very, very clear that a nuisance was created. That evidence is uncontradicted. We want to enforce the declaration, not create a loophole by blurring out the distinction between a normal use and a reasonable use. It is not a reasonable use to destroy your neighbor's property and then claim if they want it stopped, they should have to pay to fix your property. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gregory. You have just under 1 minute left. Mr. Steele.
it please the court.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you for the opportunity to actually speak in front of a high school. No one really is very thankful to be an appellee in a case, but this is it's quite a thrill for an old lawyer.
Mr. Steele, I'd like to ask you about proximate cause.
Yes, sir.
Here we have a contract that was entered with a proposed buyer, and there's a provision in the contract, paragraph 29.2, that essentially says the buyer has the option of reneging if the fumes from the beer pub are so noxious that it's not acceptable to them. My two questions to you are, does a proximate cause of necessity have to be the only cause of an injury? And assuming that it doesn't, isn't paragraph 29.2 enough to show proximate cause?
In answer to your first question, Your Honor, no, proximate cause is the cause without which the injury would not occur. So it is the direct cause, but not the exclusive cause. So if the damages were caused by several factors, one of which was the smell, and others were the market condition, the smell could still have been determined to be the proximate cause of the injury. If you can put the injury on another cause as being equally important in creating the injury, then there's a question of whether it is the proximate cause. I don't think that paragraph 29.2 bears on whether or not the smell was the cause. That paragraph was inserted in that contract as a condition to the sale. It does not purport to state that the value of the property is related to that provision. It states that the buyer, before he or she is willing to go forward and purchase the unit, has to be satisfied that they will not encounter a smell in the unit. And there's very good reason for that cause, and indeed that's part of this case, because the buyer was well aware that when he or she purchased the unit, they would be required to sign a provision stating, as it does here in 805 and 806, that they're aware of the brewery, that they know that breweries emit odors, and that they relinquish their right to complain about the normal or reasonable odors that are emitted from the brewery. So that clause was cleverly put in there.
Do they relinquish their right to make a claim for unreasonable odors?
Yes, I don't think they do. For example, if the brewery stopped brewing beer and all of a sudden started to distill a noxious material, cough syrup, absinthe, whatever, that really produced a different kind of smell, I don't think they did relinquish that right. They relinquished the right to complain about the normal smell of brewing beer. And there is nothing in this record whatsoever, and the judge comments on that, that indicates this smell was any different. It may have been more or less, depending on the quantity of beer brewed, but it was not different. So they did not relinquish every right to complain. They only relinquished the right to complain about the brewing of beer as it had been done.
Mr. Steele, Mr. Gregory cited the testimony of a number of witnesses, including four realtors who said that the smells from the brewery were unreasonable. What evidence was there at the trial that supported the view that the smells were not unreasonable?
Well, there were two things, Your Honor. One was the cross-examination of those witnesses. This apartment was basically unoccupied. So on cross-examination, they acknowledged that. And everyone knows that if you leave an apartment unoccupied for a long period of time without ventilation, that it could be a different character of air in the apartment than if it was occupied. And the other evidence was, I shouldn't say evidence. The witnesses had, all these witnesses were plaintiffs, brokers, people trying to sell the unit. They were involved and had a relationship with the plaintiffs. There was no independent evidence by anyone on the outside that this was an obnoxious odor. And in fact, some of these people did not even go into the apartment. They smelled the brewery operation. But in any case, Your Honor, the judge found as a fact, and that has to be clearly erroneous to be overturned here, found as a fact that there was no unreasonably different smell than from the time when Mr. Evans purchased the condo. So, what I am sure the plaintiff would like to do here is retry this case. And there are clearly very, very sharp disagreements on the facts. But those facts were determined as they should have been by the trial judge, and they're clearly stated in his opinion. The plaintiffs would also like to rewrite this agreement. This agreement was found to the judge to be non-ambiguous and very clear. And it was very clear to the extent that when Mr. and Mrs. Evans purchased this unit, they signed a declaration saying, we know there's a brewery underneath us, and we accept its reasonable and proper operation. There's no evidence that the operation was unreasonable. The judge even points out, I think on page 8 of his opinion, that the maintenance was fine. There was no evidence of any poor maintenance. There was no evidence that the brew people did anything differently or anything wrong. So they would like to rewrite that provision saying that, gee, if breweries emit odors, there must be something wrong. But we have testimony in the record from the brewmaster that breweries always emit odors.
Mr. Steele, let me ask you, I want to go back to the topic that Judge Graham raised on proximate cause. The trial court in its order found that the Evanses sold this property for a fair market value. What kind of evidence was there to support that finding by the trial court? I know there was a lot of evidence that from the brokers and realtors who had the relationship with Evanses that it didn't sell for a fair market value. So what supported the trial court's finding that it did?
Two pieces of evidence, Your Honor. Sally Courtney, when asked on cross-examination, did they receive a fair price given the market, said yes, they did. The buyer's broker, Skip Patterson, also said they received a fair price. And when you took Sally Courtney's direct examination and factored into it her testimony that the market when they purchased the unit was at the height, and when they sold it, was at the bottom, was very clear evidence to the judge, who found as a fact that was a fair price. That is the evidence on which the judge correctly relied, Your Honor.
Mr. Steele, I'd like to ask you about one aspect of the trial court's order. On page 7 of the trial court's order, the trial court rules as follows. Plaintiffs could have paid for alterations to the brew pub needed to reduce the smells coming into plaintiff's unit. Although plaintiffs did not have the authority to authorize repairs to a unit that they did not own, they could have reduced the delay and thereby reduced their claimed damages by offering to pay for the repairs up front. When a damaged plaintiff is required to mitigate damages, is it the law in Colorado that the plaintiff has to take extraordinary measures to mitigate damages?
It is not, Your Honor.
Do you find fault with that statement that I just read to you from the trial court's order?
Well, I find fault with it as a general matter in view of your question, as you asked your question, Your Honor. But I do not find fault with it in connection with the facts in this case. The plaintiffs could have sealed their own door. That they didn't do. The plaintiffs could have suggested that a door be put in at the brewery point. These were not extraordinary measures. I think the judge may have gone a little too far, but it's complete dicta in the case, in stating that the plaintiffs could have redone their pressurization in the unit and all of that. That would have been a very expensive thing. And if this were the only issue in the case, I think there would be some argument on it, but it is only one of many. Mitigation, the responsibility of mitigation. They could have easily mitigated the situation because that's how it eventually was mitigated and solved, to solve that provision in the contract that you asked about. They could have sealed their own door. They didn't even do that. What started out here, and it's clearly in the record, was a litigation and no attempt to mitigate. The fact is that the issue of damages itself is a severe issue that the plaintiffs cannot overcome here. In terms of the factual finding that there was no proximate cause, that there was no actual loss, they cannot overcome the fact that the use of the brew pub continued as a brew pub, that there was no limit on the amount of production, and even if there was, there was no evidence in the record. But whether, if this case was only about whether or not the plaintiffs had to take extraordinary measures to mitigate this damage, I think we'd have a different appeal here. But it's not about that. It's a very minor argument among several that the plaintiffs aren't entitled. There's other arguments too, that what is the landlord's responsibility here? What could the landlord have done? Plaintiffs argue the landlord's could have evicted its tenant because it was a month-to-month tenant. Does evicting a tenant actually reduce the odors of brewing? I think not. The next tenant would have come in and brewed the beer and done exactly the same thing. And there is no contractual obligation, that was found by the court, to evict its tenant. There is no legal obligation for a landlord to take extraordinary measures to prevent its tenant from inflicting an odor, in this case, what they characterize as a nuisance and what the court did not characterize on the tenant. So Those arguments are all part of the fabric of this case. And one thing I need to add in the 15 seconds left, plaintiffs raise in their reply brief, a response brief, that the unit was not properly maintained. And that was not brought up in the trial court, and the judge found that it was properly maintained. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Steele.
May it please the court. I'm going to obviously be brief with my 55 seconds left. As to reasonable use, you asked the question, is there any evidence that this use was reasonable? There is no evidence that this use was reasonable. All of the evidence, and not just from the Evans side, two mechanical engineers, one hired by the defendants, one hired by us, came up with a list of 10 things that had to be done. Those engineers both testified this was necessary in order to accomplish the basic mechanical engineering principles of proper containment and evacuation of this odor. Second, we do not seek to rewrite the declaration. We seek to enforce the declaration. The declaration, properly construed, allows a brew pub the normal use so long as it is operated reasonably. As to whether or not the landlord has a duty, that actually appears to be a question of first impression under Colorado law. We've cited for you decisions from other jurisdictions. Looks like I'm out of my time.
Yes, you are. Thank you very much, Mr. Gregory. Thank you again, Mr. Steele. We appreciate both of your arguments this morning. And again, I thank you both for coming such a long distance to present your arguments to before all the students this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. The court.